Judges part 7. Actually, we're not going through the book of Judges, but we're looking at Judges. And we have made it to Gideon, and this is the third lesson under Gideon's reign and judgeship. And so what we're going to look at tonight in chapter 8 of Judges is we're going to see Gideon as chief. Now let me recap what we've looked at so far under Gideon. Chapter 6, we saw Gideon called. We saw Gideon threshing wheat behind a wine press, under an oak tree, the place where you never thresh wheat. And he was doing that to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him, which we think was Jesus pre-incarnate. And he made a sacrifice after arguing with God. He made a sacrifice. God consumed the sacrifice. And then he was terrified, saying, "Oh my, I've seen God. Now I'm going to die." And God said, "You're not going to die. You're actually going to deliver Israel. Now go tear down the altars to Baal in your town, the altar to Asherah in your town. Take two of your dad's bulls, the 7-year-old bull, and kill it and offer it to me as a sacrifice." He does all that. The people of the town don't kill him, but they give him a new name, which is Jerubbaal, meaning "let Baal contend." He puts the fleece out. The fleece comes back wet, so now he's ready to go to battle. Then we see in chapter 7, Gideon as commander. Chapter 7 is primarily dealing with Gideon as a leader in the military. And that's what makes that time for Gideon unique, in that he has this 32,000 man army. 22,000 of them leave because they're afraid. Now we have 10,000. And the Lord takes them down to the brook, and then he separates them by the way they drink. And he whittles the army down to 300. He says, "Now you're ready to get a victory." Now, do you remember why God took the army from 32,000 to 300? Why did he do that? So they would depend on him, so we would be certain who got the glory. It was God. Then he sends Gideon down to the army, and he says, "If you're a little nervous, go down and listen to what they're saying." He goes down there. He has a dream about a guy that dreams a roll of barley bread, rolls down the mountain, and crushes his tent. And the guy said, "Well, that roll of barley bread, that's Gideon, the mighty warrior. You know, Gideon, the guy that's hiding behind the wine press. That mighty guy who hasn't had one day of battle yet has already got a national reputation." Okay. So they defeat the army of Midian, which is somewhere between 130 and 150,000 people. They defeat them without a sword or a spear or even a pocket knife. They defeat them with a horn, ram's horn, a picture, and a torch, and their voice. And they divide the 300 men into three companies of 100. They surround the camp of Midian, which you got to keep in mind, a camp of 150,000 people. This takes up several miles of real estate. They throw the pitcher down the mountain. All 300 pitchers start breaking, and you know what broken pottery sounds like, especially in a valley. 300 giant clay pots are broken. Torches are raised up. Ram's horn, 300 ram's horns, shofars, are blown. And then everybody in unison says, "The sword of the Lord and of Gideon," all at the same time. And that's how they won the battle. Everybody started killing each other trying to get out of there. And so that's where we're going to pick up tonight in chapter 8, verse 1. Now you can see there on your outline, we have, oh my, a perfect sermon with 7 points. So we're going to have 7 points, and we're going to go through them rather quickly. But I want you to see Gideon as chief, and I want to say how Gideon responds to his allies, to his antagonist, to the adversaries, how he responds to the Almighty, how he responds in abundance, how he responds with affiliations, and the after effects. Okay? So we'll read, instead of reading all 35 verses at one time, well, let's read these first 3 verses together. The battle has been taking place since 10 o'clock last night. We're going to pick it up first thing in the morning in chapter 8, verse 1. "And the men of Ephraim said unto him, 'Why hast thou served us thus? And thou calledest not when thou wentest to fight with the Midianites. And they did chide with him sharply. And he said unto them, What have I done now in comparison to you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God hath delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb, and Zeeb. What was I able to do in comparison to you? Then their anger was abated towards him when he had said that. Okay, let's look at how Gideon handles his allies. The reason we're recognizing him as chief now is because Gideon is now interacting with more people than just the 300 men under his command. He's now in a position of leader of Israel, and he's having to respond to complaints in Israel. The first people that we see him running into are his own allies, the men of Ephraim. Now, Ephraim shows up, and you'll remember when the army of Midian was fleeing, they were headed for the Jordan River to go back east, to get back in the land where all their family and friends were, to get out of hostile Israel, which they had been raiding for 7 years. So as they're fleeing and they're going off, Gideon has the wisdom to say, go send men to the tribe of Ephraim. Ephraim is located right near where people would cross the Jordan River to go east. He said, have Ephraim go down and cut them off. And the men of the tribe of Ephraim run down to the Jordan River, and they intercept these retreating Midianites, and they catch two of the princesses. The princes, not princesses. You know what I mean? Two men, not a group of women. So in catching these two men, these two princes, here's what happens. They now want to say, Gideon, why didn't you call us before you attacked them last night? Now, folks, let's be honest here. Gideon sent messengers out to round up troops. The other army knew who Gideon was. They knew there were 32,000 men on the side of Mount Moreh waiting. The Midianites got on the other side of the mountain and they were lining up for war. Everybody knew that Gideon was going to lead an attack on the Midianites. If the Ephraimites, the tribe of Ephraim, if they wanted in on the battle, they could have showed up like everybody else. The only reason they're saying, why didn't you invite us to the battle, is because Gideon whipped everybody in the battle. And the reason they didn't show up the first time is because they said, there's no way you and 32,000 of your closest friends are going to beat 150,000 trained Midianite warriors. But now that he routed them, hey, you should have called us. We would have helped you. Have you ever known someone that showed up after the work was done and say, why did you call me? That's what's happening in these three verses. Now, how would you respond when someone shows up after you've done a difficult task? Why didn't you call me? You, by nature, go, I did, you idiot. You didn't show up until just now. Gideon has every right, and he's God's chosen victor. Why doesn't he pull his sword out? Surely he's picked one up from the 120,000 men that have died. Why doesn't he stick his sword up in that guy's face and say, you know who you're talking to? I just went up against an army of 150,000 with 300 men and routed them. You want to be next? Gideon, I want you to notice this. He responds with humility. He says, well, you caught the princes. What did I do? Hello, Gideon. You killed 120,000 men. These guys caught two political figures that were fleeing. But he makes it appear as though Ephraim did the greater work by catching two running princes away from the battle. And he's saying, and he says, isn't your gleanings, isn't your leftover grapes better than the vintage from Abiezer? Abiezer is the family in the tribe of Manasseh that Gideon is from. He's saying, your leftover grapes are better than our fine grape juice. Sound like a politician? Gideon is doing this for a reason. It's the light in the back. The battery's going dead, and we pulled the battery out today, and we're getting another one, okay? So, yeah, it's going to probably do that about, if I preach another 45 minutes, 4.5 more times. So, why is Gideon so polite to these people? Why doesn't he rule with an iron fist? Because these people are his allies. If they were his adversaries, his response would be totally different. If they were obstinate and didn't want to help, his response would be totally different. These people were helping him, and he was grateful for their help, and he responded with humility. And like Rob said, it sounds like a politician, but more importantly, it sounds like a smart politician. Gideon was a coward, cowering in the corner earlier this past week. Now he is in the limelight and the leader of Israel, and he's responding accordingly. By the way, does anybody know what Oreb and Zeb's name mean? These two princes that are fleeing. Oreb means raven, and Zeb means wolf. I knew a couple of kids. Their middle names were Wolf and Badger. That's what we called them, Wolfie and Badger. That's what their names meant, and they were given these names as a sign of who they were, being cunning or being resourceful. So he responds with humility and willingness towards his allies. Any questions about that? It's pretty cut and dried. Let's look at how he responds to his antagonist. These people are on his side, but they sure ain't acting like it. Let's look at verses 4 through 9. And Gideon came to Jordan and passed over, he and the 300 men that were with him, faint yet pursuing them. And he said unto the men of Succoth, give, I pray you, loaves of bread unto the people that follow me, for they be faint, and I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, kings of Midian. The princes of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in thine hand, that we should give bread unto thine army? And Gideon said, therefore, when the Lord hath delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with the briars. And he went up thence to Penuel and spake unto them likewise. And the men of Penuel answered him and said, as the men of Succoth, he answered him. And he said also unto the men of Penuel, saying, when I come again in peace, I will break down this tower. I want you to realize what's taking place here. These two towns are towns and cities within Israel's border. They are filled with Jews who are the kinsmen of Gideon. And Gideon is defeating by the mighty hand of God the enemies of Israel. And these people are not so much as willing to give bread to their own armies in order that they might continue to fight the enemy. Gideon actually had the right to ask them for far more than a fast food lunch. He could have said, give us a place to stay. And by all rights, they should have housed them. He could have said, join the fight. And by all rights, they should have joined in the fight. Instead, he said, he doesn't say feed me. He says feed my men. Gideon's not asking for food for himself. He's asking for food for soldiers that are with him. He says they be faint. He doesn't say we be faint. He says feed the men that are coming behind me. Notice these men, what they say. Do you have the kings with you? Have you already caught them? Then why should we give you food? They think that the Midianite kings might win the battle. I mean, I know we're dealing with Old Testament era people, but don't you think if 120 some odd thousand people had died, that news would have got around? Don't you think if you saw Midianite kings running for their lives, that you would say, hey, maybe our guys are winning. What is the problem with these two towns? Can you see a problem with these two towns? A lot of doubt. Absence of faith. Making sure they're on the right side. But in so doing, they're on the wrong side. Now, what does that really tell us about these two towns? Who gave the victory to Gideon? These two towns are unable to recognize a work of God. They're unwilling to support God's people. They're unwilling to support those who are providing for their protection and their betterment. So what does Gideon say? When I come back to Succoth, I'm going to drag you men through the bushes. When I come back to Penuel, I'm going to tear down your tower. A tower was a stronghold. They thought, hey, we'll just stay in here in our fraidy hole, and we're not going to give you anything. We're not going to help you. We're just going to stay in our tower, and there's nothing you can do about it. He said, when I come back, I'm going to tear that tower down. These people bet on Midian and lost. They bet against God and lost. And I want you to notice how Gideon responds to his antagonist in verses 13 through 17. And I want to tell you something before we even read it. I agree with what he did. I think that's harsh and cruel, and I can't believe a man of God acted that way. Go read David. We're in war, people. This is battle. People's lives are at stake here. Quit acting like a 21st century snowflake. I'm just telling you, I listened to a few sermons today while I cleaned some windows at my house. I thought, hey, I got to clean these windows. I'm going to turn on a couple sermons. I went there and turned them off. Find me another one. Keyed in another one. We got down here to about verse 13. I can't believe a man of God would. I'm like, let me just read you verse 13 through 17. I'll make a few comments. And Gideon, son of Joash, returned from the battle before the sun was up. They went to fighting last night at 10 o'clock. Verse 13. They went to battle last night at 10 o'clock. They fought all this time. Then he's pursuing them. He captures the Midianite kings, kills the rest of them. He comes back before the sun's up. We're talking about people who have been in battle for 30 hours. And he ain't tired yet. I mean, he's tired, but he ain't letting anybody know he's tired. And he caught a young man of Succoth and inquired of him. And he described unto him the princes of Succoth, the elders thereof, even 70 men. 70 men is 77. This young man from Succoth says there's 77 leaders in the town. It's a pretty good sized town. Got 77 respected men. So he figures out who they are. Verse 15. And he came unto the men of Succoth and said, behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, with whom ye did upbraid me, saying, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna in thine hand, that we should give bread unto the men that are weary? He said, those two guys you asked me about, they're right here. Midian was the most powerful army of its day. Gideon has the two highest men in that army handcuffed. Those guys you're asking about, I brought them back to watch what I'm going to do to you. Verse 16, he took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and he taught the men of Succoth. He taught them. Do you realize that teaching requires punishment? I know you're not going to find that in a modern day book of the power of positive thinking. But biblical teaching requires punishment for wrongdoing and for wrongdoers. The Bible says the rod is for a fool's back. So if you do what's right and don't act stupid, you don't have to worry about getting a whipping. Just to give you an idea of what's taking place. Mount Moray, where they were camped at 10 o'clock when they attacked the Midianites, is 40 miles from Succoth. Penuel is 6 more miles from Succoth. Then they go and fight the Midianite kings, capture them, and travel back to Penuel, back to Succoth. By the time they get to Succoth, they have traveled within 30 hours on foot somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 miles without rest. Now, how did he take briars and thorns? I thought about this, and I thought, did he just bundle up a bunch of green briars and whip them with it? No. This saying is used to describe people who would be tied and drugged through a thicket. You say, that's awful mean. That's awful harsh. Would you rather die? Would you rather be executed? Insurrection. Running from combat. Refusing to help those in combat. Those judgments were punishable by death. People were executed for this. He made an example out of them and drug these 77 men through the thickets. And they went home and their wives sat around with tweezers all night pulling thorns out of them. And they walked around all crippled and humbled up, and they had strawberry burns from head to toe. And people said, "What happened to you?" And they said, "I didn't help Gideon when God was helping him and giving him the victory. I couldn't discern the will of God. I didn't have faith. I couldn't see God working in a man. And I voted for Midian instead," and they paid the price. But Gideon's not done. He's not ready to take a nap yet. Verse 17, he beat down the tower of Penuel and slew the men of the city. Now, I do not think that he killed every man in Penuel, but I think he killed the ringleaders. I think he killed the politicians that were refusing to help him. I think he killed the people responsible for them not receiving the bread and the nourishment they needed to continue in battle. Now, what does this do to Gideon's future reign as a judge in Israel? What precedents does this set for Gideon from now on out? What would happen if our politicians received punishment for what they did wrong? Their wives would never get the briars out. Do you know how many politicians we'd have to drag through the woods before people quit acting like this? No, just a handful of them. The rest of them would fly right or get out. The reason that all this is going on in our country and all the crooked politicians we have, even within our own state, is because they're getting away with it. I know some of you live in Oklahoma, but over here in Arkansas, they're embezzling money like it's their own piggy bank. And they're doing that because all they've ever got before is a slap on the hands. What happens when somebody like this fella here, was it John Woods that got 18 years in prison? Woods up in northwest Arkansas had a kickback scheme going, and he went to court, and he kind of like, I'm probably going to get 6 months probation. They gave him 18 years in the slammer. You know what happened in Little Rock? All these politicians started coming to the FBI going, "Do you need any more information? I'm willing to talk." Do you know what happened in Israel when these men were drugged through the bushes and these politicians who refused to help were executed and this tower was torn down? It set a precedence for the entire country. This is the way it's going to be. Word got around. I don't want to say anything. I'm not a prophet. But look, if a few people die playing stupid games, there will be less people playing stupid games. There needs to be law and order amongst our own. These antagonists were not the adversaries. They were people within Israel. And he made an example of them. And I'm going to tell you what, they had 40 years of peace after this. Everybody wants peace, but they don't want to deal with the peacemaker, the 44 Magnum. Any questions about the antagonist? In war, bad things happen. If you house Nazis and the Nazis lose, they're coming for you. These people picked the wrong side. And they paid for it. Let's look at how he dealt with his adversaries. And I'll pick up the pace here. Verses 10 and 12. And Ziba and Zalmunna were in Karkor, and their host with them, about 15,000 men, all that were left of all the host and the children of the east, for there fell 120,000 men that drew the sword. So there's 15,000 there. There's 120,000 dead. Most people believe there's probably another 15,000 scattered. That's how we round up to around 150,000 people. Gideon, verse 11, it says, "And Gideon went up by the way of them that dwelt in the tents of the east, Nobah and Jogbehah, and smote the host, for the host was secure." Gideon circled around. You would think after running 46 miles all day long chasing them, he would probably follow the straightest route. And what they did was they set up and they looked back toward Penuel and they looked back towards Succoth and they said, "Gideon's not coming." But what Gideon did was he circled around and they thought everything was safe and they thought everything was secure. And Gideon came over the backside and routed them. You know what the lesson here is? When you're at odds with God, no amount of hiding, no amount of running ever makes you secure. That's the lesson. Verse 12, "And when Ziba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued after them and took the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and discomfited all the host. He scattered everybody else. What he couldn't kill, every man for himself, they ran off. What he was after was not to execute every single person. What he was after was the two kings. So how did he respond to his enemies? He pursued them until he caught them. What would have happened if these 15,000 would have went over the hill and he never would have finished the battle? You can bet in 10 years they'd be coming back and it wouldn't be 15,000. It'd be another 40,000. They'd go get more children from the east. They'd go get more Ammonites. When you go to battle, you've got to fight until you conquer the other side. Unless you just like battling, then just fight a little while, quit. Fight a little next year, quit. But if you're going to have peace, you've got to end it. If you're going to have peace in your life, you've got to do battle with sin. And if you're not willing to battle with sin, you're never going to have peace in your life. So, he's got the two kings. He's tore down and dealt with his antagonist. Let's look at how he executes them in 18 through 21. Then he said unto Zeba and Zalmunna, what manner of men were they whom ye slew at Tabor? And they answered, as thou art, so were they. Each one resembled the children of a king. And he said, they were my brethren, even the sons of my mother. As the Lord liveth, if ye had saved them alive, I would not slay you. Background information here. All the Bible tells us is that for 7 years straight, the Midianites raided Israel. During that 7 years, Gideon's brethren were killed at the hands of Midianites. His brethren were killed at Mount Tabor. We don't have the account of that battle at Mount Tabor, but we have Gideon saying that his brothers died there, and they died at the hands of these kings. As if these kings might have ordered the execution of Gideon's brothers. And so when he says, what manner of man were they that you killed at Mount Tabor? This is a rather flattering answer when they say, oh, they were like the children of a king. Because they already perceive that Gideon is a king. And Gideon is concerned about who they are. And they already see him, not that he's going to take the office of king, but they see him as leader in Israel. And they were like, these men were like you. They were like a king. And he said, those were my brethren, even the son of my mother. Now, the closest brother you could have was a full brother. In Israel, there were a lot of half-brothers. Because a lot of men had multiple wives. David had a lot of sons. But very few of them had the same mother. When Gideon here says, you killed the sons of my mother, he's saying, you killed my closest kin. And he said, you know, if you hadn't executed my brothers, I wouldn't have executed you. Now, what Gideon desires to do in this next verse is really as bad as you could possibly be. He's wanting them to die at the hands of his young son, Jether, his firstborn. He says to him in verse 20, up and slay them. But the youth drew not his sword, for he feared, because he was yet a youth. Now, Jether didn't go to battle. They're back home. But it would be a disgrace for a king to die at the hands of a child. It would be a disgrace for a king to die at the hands of a Philistine. Remember, Saul told his armor bearer, kill me so the Philistines don't kill me. In the next chapter, Abimelech, Gideon's son from a concubine, gets hit in the head by a millstone from a woman. And he tells somebody, he says, quick, kill me. I don't want to die at the hands of a woman. That'll be a disgrace. What Gideon wants to do to his adversaries is not just wipe them off the face of the map, but he wants to rub their nose in it. He wants to let everybody know, if you mess with Israel, this is the way you're going to be treated. Now, folks, I know this ain't going to be popular, but in combat, it's war. If you ever get in a fight, a real fight, it's not a sparring match. It's a fight. I don't want to get in a fight. I don't want to go to combat with people. I don't want to get in a war. But if we get in a war, let's win it and let's wipe them out and let's let everybody know, if you go to war with us, this is what happens. If you pussyfoot around with your enemies, you'll have a lot of enemies. If you wipe your enemies out, you will have nice neighbors. If our country would recapture that idea, we wouldn't have little skirmishes flaring up all over the place. A U.S. warship would roll up into port. Everybody would get quiet and sit on their hands. But we've lost that. Gideon had that. Gideon had 40 years of peace. Any questions about the adversaries? His son doesn't kill him, so he gets up and kills him. If you have a problem with that, you have a problem with Samuel killing Agag. If you have a problem with that, you have a problem with God's decisions. It's war. In war, people die. I hate to quote General George Patton in the Sanctuary, but battles aren't won by you dying for your country. Battles are won by making them die for their country. That's the way battles work. If you have a problem with Gideon winning war, you're going to have a long, miserable life. This is the way a successful king should go to battle. Any questions about that? Since we're so close and you're halfway mad at me already, Trump's doing a pretty good job along these lines. And the media does not like what he's doing. And the liberals do not like what he's doing. But people are getting a lot more polite around America. Okay, let's look at Gideon's relationship toward the Almighty. Verse 22 and 23. The men of Israel said unto Gideon, "Rule over us, both thou and thy son's sons also, for thou hast delivered us from the hand of Midian." Israel has always wanted a king. They've always wanted a king. I mean, they just got to have that king. And I'm going to tell you what, they picked a good guy to be king, really. I mean, Gideon seems to have what it takes. And he does have what it takes to be king. But he also knows that God is the king of Israel. And look at his response in verse 23. And Gideon said unto them, "I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." Gideon realized that Israel did not need a king because they had God. And God was the supreme leader in Israel. Gideon would be judge, but he would not be king because a king passes his crown on to his son. Gideon said, "My family's not going to be the king here." Now, you want to know what's real interesting about this? Gideon said, "I'm not going to be your king, and my son's not going to be your king because God rules over you." Guess what happens in the next chapter? They forget God at the end of this chapter. In the next chapter, some fella tries to become king. And guess who he is? Gideon's son, Abimelech. God gives them what they wanted, a son of Gideon to be their king, and he causes turmoil. People are out robbing on the streets. People are trying to overthrow each other. They're killing one another. They're attacking the cities, It's almost as if Gideon gives them the wisdom and says, "You don't need a king. God is your ruler." And they said, "No, we want you and your sons." He said, "I'm not going to do it." As soon as he's gone, they turn away from God, and God says, "I'll tell you what, I'll give you a son of Gideon. I'll show you what you would have gotten had Gideon not recognized me as the Almighty." And it was nothing but turmoil and destruction. Any questions about Gideon's relationship to the Almighty? Here's where it gets bad. Gideon, to this point,'s really done a good job. He's been humble with his allies. He's been firm with his antagonist. He's wiped out his adversaries. And he's recognized God as the supreme ruler and leader in Israel. But where Gideon fails is in abundance. Money. And I want to give you an idea of how much money Gideon had at the end of this battle. Didn't somebody win the Mega Millions or something here last night? I don't know when that was. I've been seeing stuff scrolling across the screen. Big money. I want to show you just how rich Gideon was in verses 24 through 28. And Gideon said unto them, "I would desire a request of you that you would give me every man the earrings of his prey, for they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites." Earring. This is what he asked for. The piercing of the ear. He said, "Every man, give me the earring of your prey." Now, if you went up to a body that died in war, you could take his wedding band off. If he had a necklace, you could take that off. You could take his clothes off, his sandals off, his shield off, his sword off. You could have all that. Gideon says, "I just want the earring." So everybody says, "Yeah, we'll give you the earrings." They got big old gold bracelets. You just want the hearing. Yeah. 150,000 men died. I don't know which ear's which and which one men are supposed to pierce and not. But what if they all had two earrings? 300,000 gold earrings. And they answered and said, "We will willingly give them." And they spread a garment and did cast therein every man the earrings of his prey. They spread out a poncho on the ground, and everybody looked through all the gold and the silver and the swords and the raiment, and everybody got the earrings and gave the earrings only to Gideon. And the weight of the golden earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the ornaments and collars of purple raiment that was of the kings of Midian, besides the chains which were about the camels' necks. Now, I think I skipped the verse where he killed the Midianite kings and took the chains off their camels, but their camels had a gold chain. And they had a gold crescent around the front, which is a symbol of a moon, which was a recognition that they worshiped the god Asheroth, the moon god, the star god at night. So he got this big gold crescent moon. He got these big gold chains. He got the raiment of these kings. He got all his share of the stuff that he picked up. But the earrings alone weighed how many thousand shekels? 1,700 shekels of gold. I did some math. If a shekel is a half an ounce, which is pretty close to that, that would be 73 pounds and 4 ounces of gold. The spot price for gold today is $1,232.95. That's down about $600 from 4 or 5 years ago. That's an ounce price today, what gold's selling for. If you took the 73 pounds and 4 ounces and sold it for $1,232.95 an ounce, this is what the earrings were worth. $1,425,290.20. That's how rich Gideon last week. I like to put things in real time. If they got back and he killed them people, them two kings today, and the people said, "What do you want?" He said, "I want the earrings." If that happened today, Saturday, he was behind the wine press, fearing for his life, hoping the Midianites didn't show up and steal their wheat. All of his brothers were dead. They had a bull that was 7 years old. They had been hiding from the Midianites. He's fearing for his life, wondering where his next meal's going to come from. Well, then a week, he hit the lotto and got $1.4 million worth of earrings. How did he do with that? Not too good. Verse 27. And Gideon made an ephod thereof and put it in the city, even in Ophrah. And all the Israelites went thither whoring after it, which thing became a snare unto Gideon and his house. Let's talk about that. An ephod was a garment that the priest wore. Breastplate, if you will. But the breastplate wasn't worn, it was put up in the city. So think of it more than a breastplate, but maybe a bust, a statue made of gold, maybe resembling Gideon, maybe looking like Gideon's physique. And that was put up there as a reminder and a memorial of the battle of the Midianites. The problem with that was he's showing off the gold that he's been given, that he's earned by leading them, but Israel's going there and it says a whoring after it. It means that they're fornicating with another god. And what they're doing is they're worshiping and relying on Gideon's image instead of God. Now it doesn't say that Gideon did this on purpose, but this is the outcome of it. It doesn't say that Gideon did this, but the people did this. Verse 28, thus was Midian subdued before the children of Israel, so that they lifted up their heads no more, and the country was in quietness 40 years in the days of Gideon. So Gideon done his job, the battle was won, the people had peace, Everything was there. They had prosperity. Gideon was doing well. But here's the problem. As he got money, the religious condition of the people went down. You know when the last time America was really spiritual and religious? The Depression. When they didn't have nothing. You look at the spiritual condition of our country today. We have everything we want. I mean, I'm 43. I can remember 20 years ago, if you had a cell phone, you was like an important person. My boss had a cell phone. I mean, people might have to call him while he's driving somewhere. Not plugged into the cigarette lighter, but we wasn't in the house. We didn't have to put a dime in to call. He's an important person. Now, we'll give you a cell phone if you don't have one. But spiritually, we're so far from God, we don't know what blind and dead is. Abundance was bad. It was bad for Gideon and it was bad for Israel. Oh, they had peace, but spiritually they had a drought and they were poor. Any questions about that? Let's look at his affiliations. This is the absolute worst thing that Gideon did. Building the statue of himself, stupid, bad idea. Worse than that, go out and get you a bunch of wives. Don't look at it as getting more wives. Look at it as getting more mother-in-laws. Maybe that'd take some of the appeal out. I don't know what it is about, I want to go get another wife. No. Wives don't dwell well together. Look at verse 29 with me. And Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and dwelt in his house, and Gideon had 70 sons of his body begotten, not adopted kids, from his loins. Look at this. For he had many wives. Now that's obvious. Some woman had 70 boys. You start when you're 20, 9 months at a time. Do the math on this. Gideon only lives 40 years. How do you have 70 sons in 40 years? Now think about this. Gideon's not an old man when he goes to battle. He's young. His oldest son is still a youth and doesn't want to kill the two kings. I'm going to bet the kid wasn't a teenager yet. I think if he was 16, he'd have done what his dad told him to do. I bet he's 12. Gideon has that boy when he's 20. Gideon's 32, lives another 40 years. He'd be 72, he'd die in a ripe old age. 72 was old back then. With the modern medicine, it's still old. He's got 70 children. When do these 70 children arrive? He didn't have multiple wives when he was threshing wheat back behind the wine press. Couldn't afford them. When does the 70 children arrive? They arrive when he gets many wives. They happen in the last 40 years of his life. And I'm just going to go out on a limb here, even though the Bible doesn't say it, and say not every child that was born unto him was a male. Some sad looking faces on these women out here. That's a lot of kids. I mean, he could have had, what, 3 Miss Duggars? 4 Miss Duggars? Or he could have had 8 or 10 wives. Oh, we don't know. It doesn't say. But here's what we know. He had 70 boys. Now, if he's an equal opportunity, he had 70 girls. Was that good for him or bad? Bad. Everybody that's had multiple children by multiple wives under one roof has had multiple problems. Every time. There's no way around it. You can do the best you can to make it work, but it's always going to cause problems. There's always going to be jealousy. Now, why does he get this many wives? He gets these many wives because he's a person of importance. And back during this time, the way that you ensured your safety was you married the daughter of your kingdom off to another kingdom so you would ensure they wouldn't attack you. And if you were a king, you'd marry somebody else's daughter, so if you got invaded, your daddy-in-law's army would come over and bail you out. And if you look at Solomon, and the downfall of Solomon's ministry wasn't his wisdom, it wasn't his money, it was his wives. The downfall of David's kingdom was his wives. Now the guy's got many wives. He's got 70 boys, an unknown amount of girls, and notice verse 31. And his concubine was in Shechem, and she also bare him a son whose name was Abimelech. You got multiple wives. Why do you need a concubine? Which is a word for saying, I'm going to fornicate with another woman who's not my wife. That's what it means. Why are you having children with a woman who's not your wife when you have many wives and already have 70 boys? Because when you have abundance, we can take care of them. We can feed them. If we need some money, I'll go chip a chunk of gold off my golden portrait outside. I got $1.4 million in the courthouse square. It belongs to me. Everybody wants me to be the king. We're fine. These affiliations were political marriages, and they ruined his entire family. Now, let me tell you what happens in the after effect. Picking up in verse 32, and I'm not going to read all 57 verses of chapter 9, and we're not going to study it next week because this man was not a judge in Israel. It says in verse 32, I'll read down to verse 35. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died in a good old age and was buried in the sepulcher of Joash, his father, in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. Only Gideon and Samson, the only judges mentioned to be buried in the tomb of their father, their family. Verse 33. And it came to pass as soon as Gideon was dead that the children of Israel turned again and went a-whoring after Balaam and made Baal-rith their god. Baal-berith their god, and the children of Israel remembered not the Lord their God, who had delivered them out of the hands of all their enemies on every side, neither showed they kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, namely Gideon, according to all the goodness which he had showed unto Israel. What happened when Gideon died? A good judge. As soon as he died, everybody went right back to what they were doing. Now, what was the after effects? Well, he had 70 kids. Had 70 boys of his wives and one boy from a concubine. The one boy from the concubine was Abimelech. Abimelech, when he got older, said to the men of Shechem, where he and his mother lived, said, why do you want Gideon's sons to rule over you when their moms all live in Ophrah? Why don't you get a man from Gideon's family who lives in Shechem to be your king? And they all agreed. And though the men of Shechem paid a group of other men to help Abimelech go back to Ophrah, and he went back and gathered up and arrested 69 of his 70 brothers, took them out to a rock, and one at a time executed them in front of the city of Ophrah. And Abimelech killed all but the youngest son of Gideon's. And the only reason he didn't kill him was because he hid and they couldn't find him. And Abimelech killed those 70 boys. So what good did it do Gideon to have all these wives and all these children and a concubine? Because within a year of his death, all of his children, all of his sons but one, were dead. Abimelech, the son of the concubine, then became king of Shechem. Big deal. But because he wouldn't do anything, people in Shechem and in other towns that you couldn't travel back and forth among the cities because there were robbers. And then people were always jealous of Abimelech and wanting to overthrow him. And so the people would say, this person's wanting to overthrow you. And Abimelech would go kill him and all of his friends. And when you have this kind of totalitarian state where you just go around executing people without any warning, without any communication, when you go around and act like this and act like a dictator, then as soon as somebody has a chance, they're going to kill you. And he laid siege to a town that didn't like him. And the last town he laid siege to, all the people ran into a building. He stacked wood around the building and burned it down and burned all the men, the women, and the children alive inside. These people all ran up in the tower, and he started gathering up wood, stacking around the bottom of their tower. He was going to burn them out alive too. And one of the women up top grabbed a piece of a millstone that you grind corn with. And when he went up there with a log to lay on the brush pile, she threw the piece of the millstone out of the window and hit Abimelech in the top of the head and knocked him loopy. He knew he was dying. He had blood running out of his head. He's got a massive concussion. You're not going to make it. So he says, hey, somebody kill me. So they don't say, I died by the hands of a woman. Well, too bad, bud. Everybody gave the woman credit. So he died. He died at the hands of the people who actually elected him. And all the people of Shechem whom he got mad at, he killed. And the youngest son made a prophecy before he fled over Abimelech and Shechem. And he said, the two of you are going to kill each other. And that's exactly what happened. The after effect. If Gideon had not let the abundance and the affiliations overcome his home life, none of chapter 9 would have ever taken place. Questions? It's kind of a whirlwind tour, but that's the only way you can cover this much material. Gideon was an imperfect leader at the perfect time. Lots of flaws, lots of faults, but lots of good. Clearly, God's hand upon him. Clearly, God's choice. Clearly, God's victory. Still made lots of faults and failures. Questions? Of chapter 8? 9? No, I think I don't know that. I was just assuming that there he was telling the men of Shechem, he was playing the maternal side. Why do you want somebody? I'm a son of Gideon, but I'm one of you. And what this person's doing is playing the father's side. Why don't we get somebody from Shechem? His dad lives in Ophrah. So I think it's just the other side of the coin. Whether she was a Hebrew or not, I do not know. And I don't know as though we could know. But that might have been why she was a concubine. Maybe he didn't want to marry a non-Jew. I don't know.